Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy holidays to you, too. I'm very good. Very good. How are you?
Well, not bad. We're sitting here, coming to you from the past, as it were, on a Wednesday, and we're not quite sure how much snow we're really going to get.
Well, when we got here, it was a lot of snow. We did go out to the shop today, and it started snowing. And by the time we got back, there was probably 6 or 8 inches on top of my car. We took the four-wheel drive today.
Yeah. Not as many as the local weathercasters were
predicting.
You know, they like to hype that because it helps their ratings and ensures them job security.
I guess.
Incite mass panic whenever you can, I suppose.
But I suppose.
Anyway, by the time you listen to this on Saturday, it'll all be just a bad memory probably, and we'll be out riding our bikes again.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I've been waiting for you to tell me something. Are you going to tell me about your gift? Jeez, it's been like weeks.
Well, I didn't really have any updates in the interim that I could tell you about, but I do have an update this week. But first, I'll tell you that in addition to not being available in any store, it was something that only I could give myself.
And right, it's only something you could give yourself.
And it took all year to get here.
Okay.
Any ideas?
You gave yourself time off.
No.
Oh.
No.
What?
For the first time in my life.
Yes.
Just barely.
Yes.
I surpassed 5,000 miles for the year.
Woohoo!
It took me until Christmas Day.
Christmas Day. Christmas Day was like just a couple days ago.
Yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. See? That's what happens when we come into the studio. Yeah. I lose all track of time. You rode yesterday? Well, yeah. My son-in-law rode the new bike yesterday.
Yeah. I got about 18 in. It was a little damp, a little sleety, but...
You were determined.
We had a fantastic November in Northeast Ohio.
Yes, we
and
did.
I looked back at my monthly mileage. I had a better November than I did October.
Well, October, as I remember, was cold and rainy.
I don't remember much about October, but I know I rode a lot more miles.
Yesterday.
But anyway, I know that a lot of people, I know Wayne Clark posted on Facebook this past week that he got 9,000 miles for the year.
Patrick Brady just posted today 7,900 something,
right.
And he's like so many miles. And so, I'm like, that's just wrong.
Well, there are many people
job,
who
though,
rode many more miles than I did is my point. Anyway, I'm very happy about that. It's my highest mileage year ever. I finally broke 5,000. And we'll
congratulations.
See. Thank you. And we'll see what 2013 brings.
And I made a special announcement this week.
Yes, you did.
That I am officially retiring from day-to-day retail after 39 years. I will no longer spend 40 to 60 to 100 hours a week in the bike shop.
Sounds like a plan.
It is a plan.
Okay.
Anyway, do you realize that next week's show is the first of 2013 already?
Yep.
Yeah, I know.
Closing it out.
We are closing it out. All right. Our first guest this evening, and this is very exciting for me, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author named Michael Vitez. He lives in Philadelphia. His new book, which was published over this summer, it came out in August, is The Road Back, A Journey of Grace and Grit. It is the journey of an athlete, Matt Miller, and the horrific bicycle accident that inspired not only this book, but a lot of people who were connected to his experience. It was a tough read in some ways, but Michael made Matt's story irresistible and in the end very satisfying. In his biography, Michael says, quote, "I have spent my life as a storyteller. My mission has been to celebrate life, to remind readers of the richness of life, to look for the good in people." He still is a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he will be up in the first half of our show. Second half of the show, we're going to welcome multiple hat wearer, like I know like that, Jeff Archer. Jeff is the proprietor of First Flight Bicycles in Statesville, North Carolina. He's also the curator of Mombat, the Museum of Mountain Bike Art and Technology. And, as if that isn't enough, he also revived Mountain Goat Cycles, an iconic brand of mountain bike frames that he offers his customers on a one-off basis. We'll have some news and chat, and then we're going to skedaddle out of here and try and wend our way home in this blizzard of a snowstorm today. So sit back, relax, enjoy our first guest, Michael Vitesse. Thanks for joining me this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've enjoyed reading your new book, The Road Back, A Journey of Grace and Grit. I want to talk about that. But first, I'd like to hear a little bit about your background, since I've never spoken with a Pulitzer Prize winner before. Give us some insight into your work as a journalist, please.
Well, I started out as a very traditional journalist. I was editor of my high school paper, editor of my college paper. I worked summer jobs in college for a newspaper. I ran out of school. I worked at a daily newspaper in Virginia and, you know, covered cops and courts and city hall and schools and all the traditional beats. I did investigative work, and I did a wide variety of stories. And over the years, I realized what I love most is what we call narratives, you know, storytelling, you know, feature writing, but really feature writing when I can use the story to not only tell a great human interest story, but illuminate a great issue or subject. And, you know, that's what happened with my Pulitzer, actually. You know, I developed this craft in telling stories, immersing myself in people's lives, and telling really powerful human interest stories. And the Pulitzer was, I was writing about end-of-life issues and aging issues at the time, and I immersed myself in the lives of five different people who were in very different situations, all approaching the end of life, and basically told their stories. And in the course of telling these very dramatic stories, talked about the changes that were happening in America and how the decisions we make about how we die and the rights we have when we die and the technology and how we're dealing with it. And really hit the long ball. You know, it was an amazing thing to win the Pulitzer. And I sort of specialized in those kind of stories ever since, sort of using, telling stories about really ordinary people we're going through extraordinary things, and using those stories to give insight to readers into very universal things.
Well, certainly this book that we're going to talk about tonight, The Road Back, is a story like that. But you also said that your first book, Rocky Stories, Tales of Love, Hope, and Happiness at America's Most Famous Steps, was your most, and I'll quote you, felicitous and celebrated accomplishment before this new one. So what was it about that book? When was it written, and what was it about?
For years and years, I was always amazed by the people who come from all over the world and run up the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, just like Rocky, just like Sylvester Stallone in the movie Rocky. And most people in Philadelphia don't even see it anymore. It happens so often, they just take it for granted. But I am often over there for stories at the Art Museum, or I'm riding my bike or run out for a run, and I go by the Art Museum, and I was always amazed by it. And what struck me was how happy people always are at the top when they run up and they yell, "Yo, Adrian," and they celebrate at the top and, you know, do what I call, you know, the Rocky. And so I pitched the idea to my friend Tom. I said, why don't we spend a year there and see, and let's just tell stories and see what we find. We had no idea what we would find. And it was the most wonderful year. You know, we hung out there, and what we learned was that people come from all over the world every hour of every day. And what brings them to the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art is the movie and the actor. But what they're really celebrating is their own achievements in life, their own accomplishments, or they're coming for motivation to achieve things, or they've survived illnesses or gotten the dream job or a million and one things. And those steps are like a way to manifest, to bring the, you know, the message of the movie to life. And so we spent a year. We were there in all weather and snowstorms and in the summer and at midnight, and it was just great. The stories were wonderful.
Well, I will have to catch up with that one. And so I haven't read that yet. This was the first book of yours that I have read. And let's fast forward and talk about it. Tell us how you first met up with Matt Miller and a little bit about the story, which is really gritty. But go ahead.
Well, you know, the story, you say it's gritty, but I mean, the accident is pretty grisly. I will give
right.
you that. But in a way, like so many of my stories, like the Rocky stories, it's truly, I felt, a really inspiring and uplifting story. The you know, the difference between the Rocky stories book and the Matt Miller stories, you know, the Rocky stories is really a collection of of short narratives. And Matt's is really, the Matt Miller book, Road Back, is really just a great narrative nonfiction story, a book-length story, which is really incredibly dramatic. And the answer to your question is that I wrote about Matt for the newspaper, and I got such an extraordinary reaction to this. I wrote a three-part series about him after I'd heard about him, and I can tell you how I heard about him. But after I wrote that series, I got such a reaction that I said, I should continue to follow this young man. There may be a book in this. And so I did continue to follow him and at some point did take a leave and wrote the book.
Well, what happened to Matt is probably every cyclist's worst nightmare. And yet Matt seems to be just one remarkable young man. So give us a short background of what happened to Matt and when it happened.
You're right. It is, in a way, the worst nightmare. The good news is it was sort of a freak accident, though. It's not something that would happen to every cyclist. So it was November 2nd, 2008, almost 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago now. He's 20 years old. He's a third-year student at the University of Virginia. He had been a college swimmer, didn't love college swimming, and had discovered cycling, quit the swim team, discovered cycling, and discovered the sport of triathlons. And it was like a man dying of thirst in the desert discovers an oasis. He just loves to cycle, and he loves to cycle up mountains and up hills. He's got this great cardiovascular system and from all those years of swimming. And on this beautiful sort of late autumn day, on a Sunday morning, he and two classmates on the UVA triathlon team go out for an 85-mile ride. They're riding out to the Blue Ridge Mountains, and they're going to do a Category 1 climb up to the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is a beautiful road that runs along the crest of the mountains. And they have just completed their ride, and they're at the top of the mountain, completed their climb, and they're at the top. And Matt literally at that moment is on top of the world in every way. And, he's 20 years old. He's in love with Emily, his high school sweetheart. He is applying to medical school and is a 4.0 student, and he's so fit that his resting heartbeat is a 42. But they start to ride north on this parkway. They're happy. It's an easy, up-and-down ride, but they're not pushing it. They're riding single file and going southbound. This is not a road anyone takes to get anywhere. It's really only a touring road at the Blue Ridge Parkway. And going southbound is a classic car caravan, a group of old sports cars, a sports car club, and they're out for a foliage tour. And these are three 20-year-old boys, and they're, can't help but look at the Porsches and the Triumphs and all these cool old cars. And it's a 30-car caravan, and Matt, the theory is, and no one knows for sure, but that, he's only been cycling about 5 months, and while he's an excellent cyclist physically, he doesn't have the best skills because he hasn't developed a life or years of his skills, that he somehow gets distracted, rolls off the crown of the road onto the shoulder, and loses control of his bike, tries to overcompensate, and swerves right across the double yellow line into the path of the 29th car in the 30-car caravan. Hits it face first. He's wearing a helmet, but he hits it face first. At 40, the car's going about 45, and, he flies up in the air and lands on the pavement, still clipped into his pedals. Every bone in his face is broken. He stopped breathing. And he's obviously suffered severe brain injury. And the driver of the 30th car, who's like just feet away, sees the whole thing, turns to his wife and says, "That boy's dead." The driver of the 30th car, the last car also, and the family really believed this is a miracle, and who am I to argue with him? He happens to be an anesthesiologist, the one man in the world that you'd want there to open an airway to start you breathing, to keep you alive until a helicopter can come and save you. So there are many, many extraordinary things that happen from the moment of collision. That it's like the perfect storm in reverse. Everything had to happen flawlessly for him to have any chance, and it really did.
So let me take a moment and tell our listeners, yes, we're speaking with Michael Vitez. He has written the book, The Road Back, A Journey of Grace and Grit, about a young man named Matt Miller who literally face first at 45 miles an hour hit. And he actually hit the sort of the in between the windows, that structure of the Porsche, And that's right. That's what smashed his
It's an
face.
Old car, and there's a steel post at the end, on each side of the windshield, connecting the windshield to the hardtop, and he hit the steel post face first. Yeah.
So this doctor, the way he got him to breathe was just what an amazing sequence of events, something that only probably an anesthesiologist or other trauma doctor would know how to do, I would imagine.
Really, I asked around a lot of reporting, and very few doctors would know this. But, you know, it's you're a professional, I'm a professional, you know your field, your particular field really well, and people are often, when they're under anesthesia, they stop breathing, and the anesthesiologist in the operating room has to get you breathing again. And a tried and true technique is to, you know, inflict pain. To sort of trigger the fight or flight mechanism.
Right.
And so this doctor grabs Matt's totally broken face, his jaw, and tugs it as hard as he can. And that does trigger Matt's fight or flight mechanism. And he starts breathing again. He tries to get up and flee. Too.
Yeah, exactly. He tried to get up and run. Yeah, right.
He did, and this 60-year-old doctor has to tackle him, you know, or he would have gone off in the woods and surely died.
Right. Well, there are a lot of tough and inspirational people in the book. It's not just Matt. I mean, his whole family just basically drops everything. Do you have an incident other than this, you know, getting him to breathe again? When you think back on it, is there an incident that just like stands out for you that is so remarkable?
Well, you know, with me and my writing, the little things, the subtle things are often the things that I find most powerful. Like the mother who wouldn't, you know, four times she asked nurses, I know there's a contact in that eye, and they're like, there's no contact, and she doesn't give up. She, you know, her brother, her son may be brain dead, he may never walk again, he may never regain consciousness, he may never be himself, but darn it, he's not going to suffer an injury. She can't help any of that, but she can darn well make sure that he doesn't have a cornea issue or a blindness or an eye injury because they left the contact lens in. And they all think she's crazy, but by the fourth try, they do actually find the contact lens. And there are many, many, many examples of little things where, you know, and one of the things I love best about this book was that I do tell it from everybody's point of view. You know, a lot of it Matt doesn't even remember because he was in the coma and then lost the memory, but it's such a remarkable family, and one of the joys is to sort of trace back where he gets this grit and this drive, and for his parents and his grandparents, and so I do love to look at everybody's point of view in the book, his brother, his girlfriend, you know, the other riders, the guy who drove the car, you know, it's all really remarkable, and it's great to weave all those pieces together.
Well, you mentioned the guy who drove the Porsche, Ken Gregory, and he actually, I thought his story was, and his decisions about Matt were probably one of the most interesting stories in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about his story, and do you know why he decided not to contact Matt when everybody else kind of did?
You know, I agree with you. I think he's a really great character and really interesting. When I first wrote the series for the newspaper right after the accident, he would not talk to me. He just wouldn't. It was too tough. But 2 years later, when I write the book, 2 years have gone by, and it was clear to me when he finally agreed to speak with me that he had not talked to anyone about this. He just sort of shoved it down. He had driven the car. The car was drivable. He had driven it home and sort of put it in his garage and never fixed it, never drove it. You know, he just sort of froze. And, you know, it was clearly the worst day of his life. He was sure he had killed this young man. And, you know, he wasn't doing anything wrong, but it's still a horrible thing to think you've stolen the life of some, you know, 20-year-old young man. And so he did hear, he was friends with the anesthesiologist because they were in the car club together, and the anesthesiologist did keep him apprised of Matt's progress. But, you know, he just wanted to let time pass and be healed. And you know, in a way, Matt had harmed him, just like he had harmed Matt.
Sure.
And, you know, he didn't want, you know, he was glad he was doing better, but he just wanted to let that chapter fade away. And he didn't want to meet the Millers, and he didn't want to do anything to sort of keep that moment alive. And so he was, you know, no ill will. I mean, between either party, everyone realized it was an accident in the truest form, but he had no desire to meet them, and the Millers had no desire to meet him.
Well, and eventually he sold the car, as is.
He, you know, after, you know, a lot of times I find the kind of stories I write when I really immerse myself in people's lives at critical time, that the interview, the process of the interview is as powerful as the end product of the story I write. And I think that, you know, it was really cathartic for him to talk to me and relive it all. He laughed a lot and talked about it. And I think it sort of jarred things loose. And he was able to, weeks after I talked to him, sell the car.
That's a good thing.
And just sort of move on. Yeah.
Yeah. So have you kept in touch with Matt and the Miller family?
I have. You know, he's in medical school.
Oh, good for him.
I went to the Ironman with him, and you know, he's in Philadelphia where I am in medical school.
Oh, cool.
The accident happened in Virginia where he was going to school, but he's from the Philadelphia area, which is why I originally wrote about him for the paper, and he's come back to med school here. So I see him, and, you know, we do, since the book came out, we've done some talks together. That's been really fun. And... you know, he's engaged to Emily, which is a great, you know, book. The book is also sort of a great love story about fidelity and loyalty and love, and they're engaged, and that's kind of cool. So I assume I'll be going to the wedding. And so, yeah, I see him, and I see the family. I see his father every now and then. It's great. He's doing really well.
That's good. And the story is nothing less than remarkable. You know, just the fact that how he survived and what it took and all that. It was just, right. It's an amazing story, and it gives people, I think it would give people a lot of hope. You know,
I think that, people who are, you know, I find that, you know, people who are in a tough situation who are looking for inspiration and hope love this book because they, you know, if Matt can come back, they feel like, the, you know, their loved one can also have a shot and can come back. So people who are going through a trauma or a difficult time, I find really enjoy it. And just people who love a great story. And I also think, you know, it really reflects America at its best in so many ways. I mean, you know, the community that rises around him, the good that is drawn out of his old swim coach and all the people around him, you know, it's just people shine in this story and institutions shine. You know, the healthcare system really works. The medical system works. The family unit really, really functions. And I honestly think part of the reason this story really resonates with people and people respond is that, you know, Matt was from an affluent family. He'd been given everything. But he wasn't spoiled. He wasn't entitled. He wasn't a whiner. He wasn't a quitter. He didn't expect things to be given to him. He just worked so hard to try to get better. And he saw the pain he had caused his family, and he was determined to ease that pain the best he could, and the best he could was by healing, by getting better. And he just was so driven to get well. And I think people are really comforted to know that people like him are not entitled, that we really can function and produce great kids in this country.
Well, it's interesting you say that because it's been a few weeks since I actually finished the book, and mm-hmm. I was not left with the impression, even though when you say it, he absolutely was from a privileged family. I mean, his father was president or CEO of a very big company, and he was an attorney. But it never even occurred to me because what I saw was just this gritty kid who just wanted to get better. Yeah.
I love that. That's great. You know, I think that's great that you didn't, that's just what you saw. And I think that was true. I think, you know, a lot of ways he was every man. And one of the things that I loved the best about, you know, I love a lot about the book, but one of the things that was great was that he's coming home from the Iron Man, where he's just done this spectacular time, you know, in less than 2 years, right? 2 years after this horrible accident, he does an Iron Man and incredibly fast.
Right.
And he's on the plane coming home, and he sits next to a guy who's a paraplegic who's tried for the fifth time to finish it. And he had a bike malfunction this time, and he didn't quite finish, and the guy's not going to give up. And, you know, Matt realizes that his story is just completely average and ordinary. Everybody doing these Ironman has incredible stories and overcome incredible things. And he's just, you know, the most exceptional thing about his story is that it's not exceptional. And you know, everybody's fighting these battles, and I, you know, I love that he didn't think he was special, and that is one of the things that, you know, I love most about the book. Why I really wanted to write it.
One of the things you did, and I find it interesting. Here you are, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and you're a working journalist, and yet the story was turned down by a lot of publishers, and you ended up self-publishing it, which is
I did,
and that's just so amazing to me. I just can't even imagine somebody would turn this story down. You know,
it, it was really frustrating and surprising to me, too. You know, I have a very good agent in New York who's had number one bestsellers. And it's just, you know, the economy was at its worst. The publishing industry is upside down. You know, you've got print-on-demand and e-books and all these things happening. There are all these forces in play. And I'm not famous. Yeah, I won a Pulitzer, but, you know, nobody is, you know, outside of the Philadelphia has really ever heard of me. And Matt is not famous. And, you know, if his name was Matt Kamen instead of Matt Miller, I think they would have jumped at the book.
That's probably true.
But short of that, you know, but they didn't want to take the risk. And so, you know, they're very segmented. They looked at this as a sports book. And you know, sports books aren't selling well. So so many of them passed. And at some point, I decided the technology has changed so well. And I learned from my first book that virtually all of the marketing promotion I would end up doing myself. A big publisher would, you know, do it briefly and then basically stop, unless I'm, you know, super famous. And you know, I make more per book, and I have more control, and I just did it myself. And you can do that now, you know, and I'll be glad to explain to you how that works and why that's possible, because it's really kind of interesting. But, you know, you can buy it. Your readers get it the exact same way. They go to Amazon.com, they put in my name or The Road Back, and they order it, and they get it in 24 or 40 hours like any other book. But to the reader, it's absolutely no different.
I guess not.
No.
That's awesome. I appreciate that you took some time on a snowy, cold, rainy day to talk to us. The book is The Road Back, A Journey of Grace and Grit. It's by Michael Vitez. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author in Philadelphia. Wow, I really enjoyed talking to you. And I'm telling you, this book was, you know, from page one, it's pretty riveting. You don't put it down. I think I read it without putting it. It was one of those, oh, I guess I'll just stay up and keep reading. So I really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for writing it.
That's the high praise that you read it so quickly. I really appreciate that. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. And thank you for having me on your show here. I hope your listeners take a chance on it. I think they'll be glad they did.
Thank you so much, Michael. Have a wonderful, happy new year. And good luck with the book.
All right.
All righty.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Vitez is the author of The Road Back. And he joined us from Philadelphia, where he's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Ugh, the story.
That's another book I got to borrow from you.
Okay. I have to start putting my little name in them and say,
I always give them back.
I know. You absolutely do, and I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's, you know, everyone's worst nightmare.
Oh, and I'm telling you, the description of the accident is mind-blowing. And the description of this doctor reviving him is also just, it's riveting. The story's great. And this 20 years old, this guy is just,
and
he's a super kid.
And he's in med school now.
He's now, well, that was, yes, he's in med school. He's in his second year of med school, maybe.
Wow. So he's done really well in terms of his brain injury.
Yes, very well. And, I mean, the brain injury was bad, but what happened to his face was just unimaginable to me. That, you know, plucky barely describes this guy. He's amazing.
There's a new movie out. This is 40.
Oh.
It's the one that's a Judd Apatow movie. It's the sort of sequel to Knocked Up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Leslie Mann and Paul Rudd are back in their roles that they originated in Knocked Up. And there's a couple of cycling scenes in that movie. And one of them sort of reminded me of crashing face first.
Oh,
yeah. It's toward the end of the movie.
Cool.
I'd recommend that movie. It's a funny movie. We saw it on Christmas Day.
Okay.
Anyway.
Happy Christmas, Crash.
We're going to take a break here and try to get back on topic with some cycling and some news about cycling and another guest in the second half of this week's Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
This entire piece of music is played with only two instruments, a right hand and a left hand. Hands can do incredible things. But nothing compares to using them to help save a life with hands-only CPR. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Find out more about this latest method of CPR at handsonlycpr.org. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on the Outspoken Cyclist. We're doing this midweek so we can have the holiday weekend off, and we hope you're enjoying your holiday weekend right now as well. Let's move on to some news.
Okay. When I think of IBM, I usually think about computers, not much about some of their out-of-office technology that must go on. This story comes from a December 20th entry on Design Taxi, which is an online site that talks about all aspects of art, design, and technology. It may not be exactly bicycle-related, but you'll see how it could apply to bicycles as well as pedestrians. IBM, together with creative agency Ogilvy and Mather, teamed up with Dutch Children to help build a flashing pedestrian crossing in the Netherlands. The issue of road safety was a concern, as many cars do not stop at crosswalks. So IBM implemented a child's idea to create a flashing pedestrian crossing as an experiment. When someone steps on the crossing, it lights up, making it more visible to drivers, emphasizing the importance of allowing pedestrians to cross. A billboard about the child's idea was also posted, displaying an innovative message of changing the way we think and, quote, building a smarter planet. It was really, really cool. So if you go to designtaxi.com and type in IBM, I think it's just IBM crosswalk or something like that. It's really cool. There's a short video that you can see. It was very clever, but you could see how it would work for cycling too if you're walking your bike across or whatever. Or
while you're, if you're stopped at an intersection, the stop line should light up to keep drivers from right hooking you.
Yeah, that's another good idea.
Like the trucks often can't see cyclists stop there at the curb at the stop line.
Very cool.
Okay.
From Bloomberg Business Week on December 13th comes the story about the Ironman triathlon. Okay, so this is the epitome of sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Too much money.
Okay.
Okay. On the Thursday before the 2012 Ironman World Championship in Kona on the Big Island of Hawaii, Troy Ford stood in the lobby of the King Kamehameha's Kona Beach Hotel. Around him were several gaunt men with shaved legs, hands steadying their composite bicycles, costing upwards of $10,000 each. Ford is the director of the Ironman Executive Challenge Program, or XC, as everyone calls it. For $9,000, or about 10 times the regular registration price, XC provides a way to VIP the Ironman, which for the uninitiated is the 2.4-mile open water swim, followed by a scorching 112-mile bike ride and a full 26.2-mile marathon run. It's the hardest major endurance race in the world and the ultimate status bauble for a certain set of high-earning, high-achieving, high VO2 max CEOs. Ford is a sinewy 43-year-old with a shaved head. He was waiting for two of his client athletes, Jim Calarami, who's the regional manager of International Paper, and Luis Alvarez, chief executive officer of Mexican fuel tank manufacturer Sag Mikasa. Both needed their bikes tuned. So it goes on to say they take 25 athletes with what they refer to as high-touch service. Breakfast with the pros, a seat up front at the welcome banquet. This guy Ford is at your disposal. He books your travel. He'll find you out your favorite snack and have a pack waiting in your suite. When your kids get bored in the hotel restaurant, he'll improvise with a box of Coffee Mate creamers that they can use as building blocks. Ford stated that the rationale for XC is that CEOs with demanding jobs have less time to deal with logistics. That fails to account for the fact that most entrants in the Ironman races have demanding jobs because the average income is $160,000 a year for everybody who enters. And to nab a spot in the XC program, you have to have a demanding job that's of interest to race organizers. So the last part of this that I really thought was interesting was what makes getting a bib number for Kona even sweeter is that no berths are openly for sale. This year, 84 of the nearly 2,000 spots went to pros, 1,668 to people who qualified by placing at the top of their age groups at earlier Ironman events, and 205 were doled out through a lottery, and 6 were auctioned on eBay. The top bidder paid $45,605. The article goes on in more detail on these two men and how the Iron Man has evolved from its humble beginnings oh so long ago.
Hmm.
Pretty bizarre.
So you do actually have to be able to
swim,
ride, and run fast enough to qualify. It's just that if you have enough money, you can be pampered while you're competing.
And they fast track you through some of the stuff like, you know, standing in line here and doing this there.
I get no problem with that.
Right. So this goes from Iron Man to Freezing Man. PeopleForBikes.org posted this blog entry on December 21st. If you've never experienced a cold winter's day by bike, you are truly missing out. All throughout the U.S., bicyclists are braving chilly mornings and opting for their bike instead of their car. Many cities are encouraging bicyclists to get out and ride this winter by organizing winter theme events like the Winter Bike to Work Day in Boulder. In Anchorage, Alaska, more than 60 bicyclists battled the cold sub-5 degrees for the inaugural Zombie Apocalypse Winter Bike Ride. What a great name. The five-mile ride went through Anchorage neighborhoods, roads, trails, and even over a frozen lagoon. Attendees were decked out in their best zombie apparel and moved at zombie speeds, slow and steady. Chicago has created an entire website devoted to riding in the winter months called Bike Winter. The initiative has developed a huge following since its inception in 1999 and plans dozens of events each year aimed to convert more and more fair weather riders to winter warriors. Minneapolis, which was named the number 2 bike city in the U.S. by Bicycling Magazine, has a huge winter riding community. Well, geez, it's cold like most of the year. The city's website even provides tips for winter riders like using an old bike in good working condition and taking off street trails. Most importantly, they encourage riders to embrace winter and enjoy the ride. This winter, we urge you to give cold weather riding a try. Who knows? You may find it just as exhilarating as we do. And for more information on winter biking, you can browse past blogs on winter riding tips, and that's at peopleforbikes.org.
Excellent.
Yes. I knew you'd like that one. Yes.
And you got to dress for the last mile, not the first mile.
That is true, because you will warm up some.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you warm up a lot, actually. I know.
Don't forget, Joe Friel says 75% of your energy is turned into heat.
That is correct. So, and only 25% into going forward.
It's kind of depressing if you think about it
too long.
But
don't think about it.
It's nice in the wintertime that you're self-heating.
True.
Self-warming.
This is my last story, and it's my favorite. Northampton physician offers house calls by bike. Rebecca Everett from the Daily Hampshire Gazette posted this on December 15th. In Northampton, Mass., after 17 years working in hospital emergency rooms, physician Jill Griffin tuned up her bike and launched a new venture she's calling Pedal Med. Griffin, who's 53, started cycling around the area earlier this month, offering health coaching house calls to people with chronic diseases and other health issues. With realistic goals and encouragement, she thinks she can get them healthy at home and keep them out of the ER. She has been health coaching for 2 years, both by phone and at an office on Locust Street, ever since she realized that the healthcare system in the U.S. is broken because it does not support preventative care. Quote, instead of focusing on medical care, which is what our system does, we should be focusing on getting healthy, she said. The pedaling part of the business will help her keep control of her own disease, type 2 diabetes. I said if I'm going to get healthy and take care of my own diabetes, I've got to get more active, Griffin recalled. She found a free bicycle trailer on the side of the road, outfitted it with a Pedal Med sign, and loaded on a few medical supplies, and she was ready to hit the road. Northampton City Clerk Wendy Mazza said Pedal Med is the first business she has registered that does medical house calls by bicycle. And she goes and visits specific clients and she sits and talks with them and she gets them on programs like better food, more exercise, getting them on indoor bikes. It's just really a cool idea. She said on her second day in business, Griffin pedaled to the home of Karen Mandeville, 59, and Samuel Adams, 69. Most of her clients are older and suffer from chronic conditions such as Crohn's or heart disease or IBS or high blood pressure or diabetes. How about that?
Yeah.
So I think it's very cool. Griffin said the key to helping people get healthy is small steps. If you take an out-of-shape person, they have to drastically change their diet, start walking 3 miles a day. It isn't going to happen like that.
Very true.
So I thought that was a very heartwarming story, that somebody's actually using her bike to make house calls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing anything is always better than doing nothing.
That is true.
That's true.
Even a little something.
Even a little something That's is right. better than nothing.
Well, I think most of our listeners know that.
Well, time to welcome our last guest of 2012.
I know. How bizarre is that?
Somebody has to be last every year, and this gentleman has the honor.
Yes, he does, but not least by any way, shape, or form.
True.
So Jeff Archer is another bike dealer like me, only he's staying in the bike business. He is the proprietor of First Flight Bicycles in Statesville, North Carolina. He also runs Mombat, which is a mountain bike museum, and he also revived Mountain Goat Cycles. So without further ado, let's welcome Jeff Archer to the Outspoken Cyclist. Jeff, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having us, Diane.
I don't often get to talk to bike dealers, but since they're near and dear to me, it's going to be fun to learn more about you and your work. I see you post online occasionally.
Yeah, we always seem to be in the shop during business hours, so we don't get to visit with one another too often.
Exactly, and we're always too busy at Interbike.
Yeah.
So let's begin with a little bit of background about you and how you got into the bicycle business, because you didn't start out that way.
No, I started just as a kid, like a lot of people, just messing with bikes and fixing them up, and ended up, you know, heading off to college and, you know, needed book money or beer money, I guess. And then only thing I had that really worked was the bike experience, which actually landed me a job in a bike shop, which coincidentally, you know, if myself had walked into this bike shop and asked for a job, I don't think it would happen. I wouldn't hired myself then, but...
But that was then.
That was then. It worked. So, and just kind of worked my way through college, working at bike shops, and decided after I graduated I liked bikes better than engineering. So,
well, you sort of end up doing both.
This is true. And, you know, I was a computer engineering degree. So, you know, with all the website stuff and everything that we do, it does have some crossover at least.
Well, the name of your store, First Flight Bicycles, obviously you're in North Carolina.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about the background of the shop, how you picked the name, because I thought that was an interesting story, and why you decided to go to North Carolina instead of staying in the Buckeye State.
Well, if you look out your window, that would probably have a lot to do with why.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, I enjoy, you know, obviously cycling and enjoy everything outdoors, and the season's just a lot longer down here. And wasn't too interested in going all the way to Florida or Georgia. Kind of wanted, you know, still enjoy the seasons, which we are having a little bit of now. But, you know, the First Flight name we'd kind of, you know, thought about. And I kind of like things that have all secondary or kind of hidden meanings. In First Flight, you know, the Wright brothers coming from Ohio and being bike mechanics and coming down to North Carolina to find fame and fortune. So just kind of following in their path and kind of use the name.
Yeah, it sort of all ties together. It does make a lot of sense. When did First Flight first open?
We have been in North Carolina since 1988.
Wow, so you've been around a while.
Yeah.
One or two decades. Very yeah. nice. I want to congratulate you on becoming a top 100 retailer this year.
Oh, thank you.
And here's one of the big reasons. It's, there are only two people who work at your store.
Correct.
And I think that's very cool because normally bicycle retailer top 100 dealers are big stores or multiple chain stores. And here's your store, which is not huge, evidently, in terms of people. How big is the floor plan of your store? How many square feet do you have?
We're actually like it's in a kind of a historic downtown area, and it's a 1920s era building. And we've got two floors, and they're 5,000 square feet each.
Wow. And two people can cover 10,000 square feet of space? That's amazing.
Yeah, it keeps us busy.
So you use roller skates or whatever?
Not quite.
Okay. Your shop is located near a bike trail. Did a bike trail change the scope of your business when it opened? That's always an interesting question, I think, for shops.
I think a lot of it, you know, as people have more opportunities, you know, obviously it's something that more people are going to get out and take advantage of those opportunities. So I think any facilities, whether they're greenways or trails, really, you know, help the industry a lot.
And so how far is the trail or greenway from your shop?
There's several trails.
Okay. You
know, one is kind of a small urban trail in town here. It's just a couple miles away, and that's a mountain bike trail. Then we have a 6 mile greenway in town, and that's about the same distance. And then the big trail, it's one of the, kind of the projects we've been working on for the last dozen years, is the Atusi Trail at Lake Norman State Park. And it's a little over 30 miles, a single track trail.
That brings us to pretty much what I really want to focus on, which is the interesting and sort of unique aspects of First Flight. One is that you preserve history, and I thought that that was a very interesting comment that you made on your website. Can you tell us a little bit about how you do that at your shop?
We have somewhere around 400 vintage bikes here. The oldest, which is a question we get quite frequently, is about 1869. And we can trace it up through. We have the ordinaries and the high wheels and then the hard tire safeties, and just kind of goes and progresses through the eras, which is kind of neat because, you know, nobody can come in here that we don't have a bike that they could have had when they were a kid. And, you know, that's always kind of a touchstone for a lot of people. But our kind of emphasis has been on kind of a vintage mountain bike theme, which, you know, a lot of people look at the mountain bike and say, well, that can't be vintage, but, you know, we're over 30 years of mountain biking now.
Right, right. Interesting. Well, why did you decide to focus on mountain bikes as opposed to, say, road bikes or any other style, kids' bikes? But you actually decided that mountain bikes, which is unusual because it, you know, I most people do focus on road bikes.
Yeah, there's a lot more out there, which is good for us. It makes them a little easier to find.
What, mountain bikes?
Yeah, but, well, if everybody's looking for old road bikes, it makes mountain bikes a little cheaper for us, probably.
Well, true that. Okay.
But no, it was mainly, you know, my first mountain bike I got in late 1983 when I was in college and working your way through, you know, making $5 an hour and, you know, flipping open the magazines and seeing $2,500 bikes and, you know, kind of calculating on the back of the napkin how many hours you would have to work to afford one of those. And we just kind of started looking, and some of those bikes were, you know, kind of on the secondary market, and they were just kind of old and I guess, technically obsolete. And they were available for, you know, just several hundred dollars at the time. So they just kind of started accumulating. And I looked at most of the people, you know, I had a Stingray when I was a kid, and people that had just these really, really killer collections of Stingrays, you know, probably started in the late 70s or early 80s when those bikes didn't have any real value to them. They were just old bikes. But they were able to kind of, you know, take the best ones that they could find and then just kind of keep them. And I guess that's kind of, we were trying to get ahead of that curve with the mountain bikes.
So do you have a favorite bike in your collection?
You know, we get that question quite a bit.
I'll bet you do.
Yeah, and favorite's kind of a, you know, it's like your favorite son. It's pretty tough. But, you know, we've got a couple of, you know, most people pretty much will acknowledge that Joe Brees made the first purpose-built mountain bikes, and he made, you know, 10 of the first series. One of those, I think Joe just donated it a month or two ago to the Smithsonian, so it'll be on exhibit there. And all 10 of those are very well known, but then he did 25 Series 2 bikes. And we do have number 9 and number 10 out of those. And that's probably, if I had to pick, you know, those are a couple of my favorites.
Do you have a bike that you think is more unique and different from any of the others?
Not necessarily in the mountain bike, but probably the one that we get the most inquiries about. We've got it's a 1960 Bowden Spacelander, which is kind of a fiberglass, very space-age kind of monocoque frame.
Really?
And the fenders are all kind of molded in, and it's a very, very, you know, obviously old but very futuristic-looking bike. And it's, when they made them, they actually, the color is molded into the frame, into the fiberglass.
Right.
And this one started out life as red, but it's kind of faded to a kind of pinkish color. So that's the one we've got it here, you know, up on the display at the shop, and that's the one we probably get the most people look at it, and, you know, you kind of see them looking that direction. They go, oh, what's that pink bike? So
let's talk a second about Mom Bat.
Mm-hmm.
What is Mom Bat?
That is the Museum of Mountain Bike Art and Technology.
All right. So I'd like to focus a little bit on the art side of that. Where's the art coming from?
That was something when we had Ross Schaefer, the founder of Salsa, out. And that was kind of one of the the things that he emphasized was, you know, you kind of look at some of the craftsmanship and the details, and, you know, we've shown bikes and pictures to people that don't particularly appreciate bikes, but they can really look at some of these small details, whether, you know, a drilled out dropout or, you know, the lug work, and really kind of, you know, appreciate it. And, you know, those folks that do that for a living and do it well, you know, they really are artists.
Well, that's sort of why I went there, because a lot of the custom builders we interview came from an art background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Archer. He is the owner of First Flight Bicycles in Statesville, North Carolina. Where is Statesville?
Oh, if you look on the map, if you find I-77 and I-40, it's right where those two interstates cross, and that's about an hour north of Charlotte.
Got it. As with, you know, so many bicycle retailers, you wear a lot of different hats. So you have your vintage collection, you have your regular retail store, and you're also involved with Mountain Goat Cycles. And I remember Mountain Goat Cycles as having some really cool paint designs. Isn't that the right company? Am I thinking the right company?
That is correct.
Yeah. Tell us about Mountain Goat and how you ended up with it.
It was something that, you know, with kind of our involvement with the vintage mountain bikes, you know, a lot of people would seek us out, and, you know, they had an old, you know, I heard you had Chris Chance on the show, you know, they'd have their old, or Yo Eddie, and they'd say, well, I really like the bike, but, you know, I've gotten used to the suspension and the better disc brakes. Can I upgrade that bike? And, you know, you really can't.
Right.
It can be done, but, you know, it really destroys what they probably loved about the bike to begin with. So we really kind of gave a lot of thought to, hey, let's, you know, get something that kind of has the, you know, the vintage aesthetic, but fits the modern parts and modern performance. Looked at a couple different brands that, you know, had been some of our favorites, and, you know, Mountain Goat was one that I think Jeff Lindsay was the original owner and ceased probably around 97. And this was 2005 when we were looking at bringing it back. So I'd gotten on the phone, called Jeff up, and told him what we were thinking about. And he's like, that sounds pretty interesting. He goes, do I have to have anything to do with it? And I said, well, no. And he goes, well, have fun. So that's how it started.
Cool. So who's actually making the bikes under the Mountain Goat Cycles name? And are you the only one selling them?
Yes. We are the only ones that will sell those. We work with the end user, the customer, and they tell us what they want. And depending on what they want, we work with several different custom builders, but primarily the CSIP and then Curtis Inglis.
So how many mountain goats are you actually turning out of here? So that's sort of your little custom mountain line.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it.
And it's you know, it's not something that we're trying to make a living off. It's kind of keeping the brand alive.
Sure.
So, you know, it's one of those things, if we do 10 a year, we're pretty happy about it.
So what other bikes do you carry in the store? What are your regular brands?
Regular, we do the Trek line and then Salsa.
We actually met up with Ross Schaefer in Petaluma last year.
Yeah.
What a character.
Oh, yeah. He
such
came
a cool
out.
Guy.
We had a vintage-themed festival in 2005, and he came out and stayed at the house for 3 or 4 days. And, yeah, he's a great guy.
He is. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit and ask you a couple of questions about your perspective on the bicycle industry. So I think it might be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about it from a bike shop owner's perspective. What do you see as the future of the brick and mortar store for bike dealers?
I actually think for bike dealers, I think it's pretty bright. It's like a lot of the industries now, you're starting to see a little more interest in, you know, keeping things local, whether it be a, you know, farmer's market, and it just seems like there's a lot of, you know, kind of a groundswell of support for the local businesses, knowing that, you know, return more investment to the community and, you know, have a lot of involvement, whether it's with the, you know, school systems or charities, and a lot of that stuff people are starting to recognize, and I think like any other industry, if you do it very, very well, people will find you and support you.
Are you changing the way you're doing business because of the impact of online selling?
You know, the online thing's not going away, so, you know, it's just something that we have to learn to adapt to and work around, and You know, there's certain aspects of it that, you know, we can't, you know, as consumers, you know, it's hard to ignore what's going on out there because of, you know, price pressures and stuff. But then we also see a lot of people that maybe had mail ordered something that, you know, wasn't necessarily built for the purpose that they were going to use it for. And when they come in and ask for advice, you know, it's kind of explaining to them, you know, what that, you know, part or derailleur may not be compatible with what they already have on their bike. And that's something I think, you know, the bike dealers are kind of in a unique situation that there is a lot of, you know, usage specific parts or parts that are not compatible with others.
And so the consumer ends up with something he or she can't use.
Yeah, and, you know, we're kind of sometimes put in that awkward position that they want you to, you know, exchange it for the
right
part or something. And, you know, it just, that's a tough conversation, but, you know, it's one that we have to have. And, you know, we try to explain it to them and, you know, tell them that is why we're here. And, you know, most people will get it after that. And, you know, sometimes it just takes that gentle nudge.
Yeah, and I can remember many conversations with my father who always ended them with, not everyone is your customer.
Yeah.
You know, you have to like sometimes pick and choose. Have you got anything new that's going to be happening in 2013 that you haven't told me about yet? Or are you just more of the same?
Yeah, I was going to say, we just try to keep doing it better. We're doing some little shop work here and doing a little rehab in the back. And
oh, good.
Making a nice little lounge area, so...
Well, I know you have a longer season than we do, which
yeah.
I wish I could say we had a longer season than we do, but we don't. But I wish you a lot of luck in 2013. I'm really happy to have been able to get to know you better and to learn about First Flight bicycles. So why don't you give our listeners your website?
Most of them are pretty easy because it's just firstflightbikes.com, and that is with an S, and then Mombat, mombat.org.
Okay.
And mountaingoatcycles.com.
Oh, I see. All three hats at the same time.
Oh, yeah. We've got to keep switching the hats. We've got to do it quick.
That's right. Well, Jeff, have a great holiday.
You do the same.
And we'll probably meet up at Interbike.
There's a good chance.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jeff Archer is the owner of First Flight Bicycles in Statesville, North Carolina. Get it? First Flight, North Carolina. And
I think we got it.
Got it. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
And for 2012.
For this year.
Yes.
Yep. Who knows what might be in store in 2013.
The first thing I'd like to say is thank you to everybody for listening in 2012. We hope you'll join us in 2013 and have a very happy, healthy, and safe new year.
I will second that and invite you back next week for another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist to start off a new year. Ride safely until then, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.